those studies that you begin, and then you, as you're going along, you just see a lot more things that could be said or studied, or verses that could be covered, and so forth. So that's kind of how tonight's lesson came about, in reading in 1 Corinthians and also in Romans, and going past these two portions of Scripture that mention the Bema Seat of Christ, Romans 14, where we have the first mention of it, and then in 1 Corinthians 3. So in both of those, I just saw some similarities, and I call it judging, you know, judging our brother. We're admonished not to judge or condemn. So read the first paragraph with me. Two passages are important when we think of the Bema Seat in relation to our brother or sister in Christ. 1 Corinthians 4, 5, where we will start tonight, and then Romans 14, 10 through 12. Both are in the context of the Bema Seat, and both are directly related to our attitude toward other believers. And uniquely, both passages end with a very similar admonition that that we will stand before God for ourselves, not for someone else. So we're supposed to be careful how we handle these things, not worry about how other people do it. So turn in your Bible to 1 Corinthians chapter 4. And my first point is that you'll remember that it's in 1 Corinthians 3 where we have the most extended passage about the Bema Seat. That's where, you know, we have the description of the wood, hay, and stubble, gold, silver, and precious stone, the foundation, no other foundation can any man lay. And so in following that same thought, Paul comes all the way down through the end of chapter 3 and begins chapter 4, let a man account of us as the ministers of Christ, stewards of the mystery of God. It's required in stewards that a man be found faithful. But with me is a very small thing that I be judged of you, or man's judgment. Yea, I judge not mine own self. Being very careful about what conclusions we reach about other people, it's still the Lord that's going to judge us in the end. So look at verse 4. I know nothing of myself, yet am I not here justified, but he that judgeth me is the Lord. So verse 5, the verse that we're dealing with, says, therefore, that's to all of us now, judge nothing before the time until the Lord come. So we ought to, we know what that is. I think no doubt he's speaking of the coming of Jesus at the rapture, when he comes to take us in the air, and of course, then we will go to the Bema Seat immediately after the rapture, who will both bring to light the hidden things of darkness and will make manifest the counsels of the heart. Then shall every man have praise of God. So back to my notes. Number two, judgment is a controversial topic today, and so every time we talk about judgment, we have to make a couple definitions about it. Number one, we're told often not to judge, and in those contexts, we're told that, of course, it's correct. Judge not that you be not judged, Matthew 7:1. And those kinds of things. Each of those probably has a certain context. Like in Matthew chapter 7, the context is more the Jewish people trying to make up their mind whether Jesus is really the Messiah or not, and they're judging the wrong way. To some of the epistles where, like we have here, we're not to judge our brother for certain things. But secondly, then there are other things that we are to judge about. As a matter of fact, you can't live your life without making judgments. You make decisions. You make a judgment between one thing and another thing. And it's in chapter 5 of this book, in the very next chapter, that he'll deal with that problem of fornication in the church, remember? And then he will say at the end of that chapter, verse 12, for what have I to do to judge them that are without? Nothing. I don't go out on the street here and judge the lost person walking down the street. Do you not judge them that are within? The answer is yes. So he says, them that are without, God judges, but for you, put away from yourselves that wicked person. So they were to deal with that and make a judgment about it and do it. So we know that that's true. We can't just make blanket statements and say never judge about anything, because that wouldn't be right. But on the other hand, we have to be careful about what we judge so that we're not judging the wrong thing. And that's kind of the subject of these two passages that we have. All right, so next, 1 Corinthians 4:5 specifically tells us not to judge thoughts or motives which we cannot see. These things are the counsels of the heart, or the hidden things of darkness, as this verse says. We cannot rightly determine invisible motives, right? I mean, so when the Bible is usually speaking to us as believers about not judging one another, it usually has to do with this kind of thing. You can't watch a person walk into the room and look at the expression on his face and say, oh, well, you've been bad, haven't you? You don't know. You can't judge those. Now, your mom probably could, but you can't somebody else, you know. So we understand that really is judging in a wrong way, to imagine that you know what somebody else was thinking, and you know that was wrong, or you know, whatever. Okay, so we can understand that. And, of course, what is he saying? But the Lord does, and the Lord knows what you're even thinking. And so when you stand before him, obviously those things can be a subject of his judgment on you, because he does know those things. Those are open before him. But you can't, is the point. Now, I also say here, however, we are to judge visible actions, as like I said up above, that violate scriptural commands. And the New Testament has specific direction on how to deal with those things. So whether it's, I use Matthew 18 here, you know, where we have the Lord's instruction about go to somebody one-on-one, and if they don't hear you, go with other people and so forth. We know how to do that. And then in chapter 5, which we just read a minute ago about the man that was involved in fornication. So those kinds of things are different. Okay, and then lastly about this verse. This verse ends with the admonition, then shall every man have praise of God. This is kind of interesting to me. Just a minute. Sorry, I should have turned that off. That's Michael, our son, says they are getting almost 20 inches of snow in Denver right now. They sent pictures of the screen on the front of his house, just snow, not that deep, but I mean blown against the snow to where you can't see out of the house. So be thankful we're just getting wind up here in Kansas City, because they're really getting it out there. Okay. Look at these. If you go back to chapter 3 and verse 10, follow these verses that I have there on the sheet. According to the grace of God, which is given unto me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation, and another buildeth thereon. Notice, every man take heed how he buildeth thereon. What I'm showing you is that how many times he mentions everybody, each person. So we're all going to stand before the Lord. No one's excluded, but each one of us stands for himself. Then in verse 13, every man's work shall be made manifest. Verse 14, if any man's work abide, which he hath built thereon, he shall receive a reward. Verse 15, but if any man's work shall be burned, he shall suffer loss. Verse 17, if any man defile the temple of God, him shall God destroy. And verse 18, let no man deceive himself. If any man among you seemeth to be wise, let him become a fool. And all the way down to verse 21, therefore let no man glory in men. All things are yours. And so by the time he gets to the end of verse 5, our verse, he says, then shall every man have praise of God. So you see the emphasis all the way through the whole teaching on the Bema Seat of Christ is the individual's responsibility, yours and mine, for ourselves. The rewards are there for any person. The judgments are there for any person. And all of us have to consider that for ourselves, really not for another person. So no wonder that he ends this verse in that way. Okay, I think that verse, pretty straightforward, pretty easy to see. Any thoughts or questions? Any man, any woman have an opinion? Okay. Back to your left a couple pages would be Romans 14, which is a unique chapter and a little more involved in this way, where we have what is called a weak brother and a strong brother, and one judging the other and the other condemning that one. So notice my paragraph at the bottom. The Romans 14 context is important. There were many Jewish converts. Let me stop and put a caveat in here. Because this chapter is important in this regard, there are a lot of opinions about it. And so commentators and so forth will differ in various details. And some don't even think Paul was writing about Jew and Gentile. But the majority of conservative writers do, and I concur with that seems to be from the examples that he uses about Sabbath days, holy days, and dietary laws and so forth. I think he's got to be talking in this regard. There were many Jewish converts who are here would be the weak brother in Rome, who were slow in overcoming their old obedience to the law. After all, it was God's law and inspired. Imagine 1,500 years. I mean, you know, you and I live in America that's only 200 years old, and we fight over the Constitution, don't we? We fight over the details of it. We want to make sure that, you know, it's carried through. Imagine 1,500 years from a constitution that God dictated on Mount Sinai. And now someone's coming along telling us you don't have to do that anymore? That can change? And so, yeah, all the events of Christ and everything had happened, but of course the Jews were not believing that. And so now these missionaries, these apostles go out to these Jews wherever they lived, all the way over to Rome, up to Galatia, wherever, and they're bringing this message about the grace of God and believing in Jesus who died and rose again, and that the law is now, the obligations to the law is over. And these Jews are scratching their heads saying, no, we've died for this. We love this. I practice this. And so it's very difficult. Now, so the point is that when a Jewish person got saved, he didn't just all of a sudden say, oh, good, I got saved yesterday. Give me a pork chop. I can't wait to eat one, you know. That probably still the smell of that pork cooking still made him sick at his stomach. He could not bring himself to do that kind of thing, okay? That's the point. But their Gentile brothers, who were here, I think, just termed as the strong ones, did not have those problems with dietary laws and holy days and things like that. So Paul exhorts the weak brother not to judge the stronger brother because he partakes. Neither should the stronger brother, I should have put the word condemn there, condemn the weaker brother because he abstains, or vice versa. So you can see that happening, right? You can see the Gentile person saying to the Gentile Christian, saying to the Jewish Christian, "What's wrong with you? You don't have to do that anymore. Come on, you know." And yet you can see the Jewish person saying to the Gentile, "Why are you eating that? You know, why are you doing that?" And Paul deals with it. Someone noted, and I thought this was interesting. We'll turn over to 1 Corinthians here in a little bit because they dealt with the same problem. But, you know, the Roman church had very few problems in it, especially when you think compared to Corinth and the problems that are brought up in 1 and 2 Corinthians. This Roman church, at least from the book that we have, had very few problems like Corinth had. And yet, here's one thing that Paul brings up that they need to be careful about. So, if this is the only thing they were dealing with, or at least compared to other things, they were doing pretty well. Okay, go to the back side of the sheet with me. Okay, the issues then in Romans 14 were non-moral. This is important. He's not talking about fornication or adultery. Paul wouldn't be talking like this. These are things that are non-moral and don't contradict any New Testament biblical command or something like that. Okay? The word for it that commentators, theologians, and so forth use is adiaphora. That is indifferent. Diaphora would be difference, and this would be an indifference. And so they talk about the adiaphora, the indifferent things. You can take it, you can leave it. You can do that if you want. You don't have to do that if you don't want. There are lots of things like that now. Okay? Paul would not have such patience with doctrinal errors. Think of the book of Galatians. You know, if any man preach any other thing unto you than what I preach, let him be accursed. Or with the moral issues like he does in chapter 5 of 1 Corinthians and other places where he deals with, he brings out his big artillery for doctrinal errors and moral errors. He's not doing that here. These issues were things that could be left alone or done. It wouldn't matter in the Christian life. But the weak brother still had a conscience against it and therefore could not do it. For example, the new Jewish Christian could never eat pork. And probably, if you ask him to go help you in your field on Saturday, he couldn't do it either. That was the old Sabbath. He cannot do it. You know that later in Christian history, especially after the Reformation, the idea of a Saturday Sabbath had been dropped among believers. We know that we don't have to keep that Sabbath. But especially the Reformed, the Calvinistic thinkers, the Puritans in England made Sunday the Sabbath. So they just said Sunday is the Christian Sabbath, whereas Saturday was the Jewish Sabbath. And therefore, you know that for a long time in the churches, you didn't do anything on Sunday, just like the Jews before did not do anything on Saturday. Who's the runner, Chariots of Fire, Eric Little, you remember? It's a true story, you know, wouldn't run in the Olympics if he had to run on Sunday. And, you know, made a big deal out of it. Well, the fact is that even Sunday, There's no command in the New Testament about making Sunday a Sabbath. It is a day we worship. But if you have to go mow your lawn on Sunday afternoon, you're not sinning before God if you do that. Now, I've had some good friends that grew up. Matter of fact, our good friend Leon Blosser, who was our song director out in Colorado, grew up in a Mennonite church all of his life. And then became a Baptist later. And he, to the day he died, could not go out and eat at a restaurant on Sunday. Just could not do it. And other people might be going out together to church. He couldn't bring himself to do it. And you know what? Nobody, we didn't bother him about it. That was his conscience. Fine. Is there anything wrong with going home on Sunday instead of eating out? No. That's fine, too. And the truth is, there's nothing wrong with going out and eating on Sunday. But we wouldn't hurt his conscience about it. And he was a pretty strong Christian. You didn't hurt his conscience, really. But, I mean, that's just what he wanted to do. It was fine with everybody else. Okay? So we know those kinds of things go on. Secondly, in actuality, the strong brother was doctrinally correct, after all. As a matter of fact, notice chapter 14 begins with the word, "Him that is weak in the faith receive you, but not to doubtful disputation." So Paul points out that there are some like that. But look at chapter 15, verse 1. "We then that are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak." Paul places himself there because, obviously, he knew what was doctrinally correct and not. Chapter 14, verse 14 says, "I know, I'm persuaded by the Lord Jesus, that there is nothing unclean of itself." You can eat the pork, you can eat the catfish. "But to him that esteemeth anything to be unclean, to him it still is unclean." So Paul does put himself in the category of the strong simply because, after all, he's the apostle who's giving us inspired information here, and he knew what was right. All right? So there is nothing wrong with eating pork or working on Saturday, the Jewish Sabbath, but the issue is not so much about that as it is about the growth of the weaker brother and the attitude of the stronger brother. That's what Paul's guarding against here. He doesn't care so much whether the Jew yet can do something on the Sabbath or whether he can eat the meat or not. But he is concerned about not losing that brother, driving him away because you keep offending him. And he's concerned that that Jewish brother doesn't keep putting his finger in the Gentile brother's face and saying, "You sinner, you're doing it," you know. So Paul, that's what Paul's guarding against. If he, the weak brother, is forced against his conscience to eat pork or to play ball on the Sabbath, he may either fall away from the church, or he may learn to indulge in immoral things and ignore his conscience altogether. So stop here for a minute and let's go over to 1 Corinthians, to that verse I have there, 1 Corinthians 8. You'll remember these verses when you see them. He's talking about idols here and meat offered to idols. So he's, I skip all the way down to verse 10. I think we can pick it up there. "If any man see thee, which hath knowledge," kind of the strong brother, "sit at meat in the idol's temple, shall not the conscience of him that is weak be emboldened to eat those things which are offered to idols? And through thy knowledge, though your knowledge may be correct, shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died? But when we sin so against the brother and wound their weak conscience, we even sin against Christ." So you see the picture there, right? Now, another little caveat, maybe this is worth saying, maybe it's not, but there is an issue over meat offered to idols, whether or not they should even eat it or not. I'm going to bring this back up here in a minute, but they had one word for this, idolothoton, I think it is, idolothoton, that which is offered to idols. We have it translated in a long phrase, that which is offered unto idols. And remember in Acts chapter 15 when they wrote a letter to Gentile Christians up in Galatia and they said, "Don't do these things because you have Jewish people among you." Remember? Don't eat meat with the blood in it. The fact is you can eat meat with the blood in it, but don't do it if the Jews are there because you know how they think about this. And don't eat meat offered to idols. Well, so here's a command from Paul, that we still find in the book of Revelation to the seven letters to the churches. So whether or not they should ever eat meat offered to idols is a question, you know, because of that command. But otherwise, he says here, even in this chapter, we know that an idol is nothing. And I don't care what kind of little rigmarole they went through to designate this meat for their god, none of that matters to me. You know, if it's a good steak and cooked the way I like it, I'm going to eat it. But maybe even a Gentile who was in that all of his or her life comes out of it and now doesn't want anything to do with that meat because he or she may have realized I was doing it because it was offered. So look at this. You see the other reference there to chapter 10, verse 28? If any man say unto you, this is offered in sacrifice unto idols, eat not. I should back up, I suppose, and say. Verse 25. Whatsoever is sold in the shambles, eat. Ask no question for conscience' sake. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. But if any of them that believe not, here's an unbeliever, bid you to a feast, and you be disposed to go, whatsoever is set before you, eat. Asking no question for conscience' sake. You don't have a problem with it. But notice, but if any man say unto you, ah, this is good meat, isn't it? It was offered to my God yesterday on the altar down there. This is an unbeliever saying that to you. Paul says, immediately stop eating. Because now you're going to offend that person, or you're going to, not offend so much as you're going to say that he was right. And not eat that idol meat, or you're eating it because he's eating it. You should stop and say, I don't think there's anything to do with idols, and if you're making a deal out of this that it's good meat because it's offered to your God, then I won't do it. And even he brings up conscience in verse 29. Conscience, I say, not thine own, but of the other. Why is my liberty judged by another man's conscience? Because I know the grace of God. I can take it or leave it. All right, back to Romans, so we don't run out of time here. The remedy that Paul gives is for the weak and strong brother to encourage one another and not judge or condemn. Verses 2 through 5. If one believeth that he may eat all things, and another who is weak eateth herbs, let not him that eateth despise him that eateth not. And let not him that eateth not judge him that eateth. God hath received him. Who art thou that judgest another man's servant? To his own master he standeth or falleth. Yea, he shall be held up. God is able to make him stand. One man esteemeth one day above another, like the Sabbath day. Another esteemeth every day alike. Let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind. And he goes, and let me finish the type statement here. We all walk before God in the stage of our Christian growth and will answer to him alone for how we responded to his leading. In other words, if that new Jewish believer still has that problem with eating those kinds of foods or doing something on the Sabbath day, give him time to grow. He'll learn. What's wrong with it if he wants to do it that way? Not hurting you. That's the point. So in verse 6 through 8, he says, he that regardeth the day regardeth it unto the Lord. I mean, he's really trying to do it because he believes this is what he should do before God. He that regardeth not the day to the Lord eateth not regard it. He that eateth to the Lord, giveth God thanks. He that eateth not to the Lord eateth not and giveth God thanks. None of us liveth to himself, no man dieth to himself. By the way, which does not mean, don't forget, there are other people in this world besides you. I think, rather, it means always remember you're doing whatever you're doing before God. You don't do anything without God's seeing it and approval or disapproval. Whether we live unto the Lord. Whether we die unto the Lord. Whether we live or die, we are the Lord's. Next point. I do not believe, personally, that we should include questionable practices. Let me stop and ask before we go to that list, to the paragraph above. Can you think of things in your life that at one time you didn't do? Maybe you got this from your family or the way you were raised or whatever, and then later you kind of changed your mind on that? A common one, for example, is playing cards, right? And I hope I don't offend anybody because somebody, but, you know, I've always been around people who, a generation ago, you just did not play cards. Now, part of that was a witness thing because of the gambling and all that the cards were used in. Some of it was an old, I think, canard about the face cards being depictions of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Various different things like that. You know, I've also seen people who came out of that family history and then kind of slowly put it away. Yet, I had a pastor friend till the day he died who would not. And if you were playing games or whatever, if it came to using cards, he just did not do it. Never did. That's a common one. What else? Think of anything else like that? Don't want to offend somebody, huh? I didn't hear what. I'm with you there. You know, Ann's brother Sam, what he did was he was asked to wash the dishes, so he purposely broke one every time he washed, and finally, his mom said, "You're not washing anymore." Oh, well. Okay, so you get the idea there. All right. I don't believe, however, that we should include questionable practices in these categories. This is where I think the discussion about Romans 14 sometimes gets off the rails a little bit. Many things we eat or drink cause real harm to our bodies. You might not be able to find a chapter and verse that says, don't smoke marijuana or take other opioids, you know, or things like that. But if they hurt your body, then there are principles about that in the Bible that we should be aware of, right? So when you get to those kinds of things, I think it doesn't quite fit the context of chapter 14. Because I think in chapter 14 you're talking about adiaphora, indifferent things. It makes no matter either way. And then also those things that can be harmful to our testimony, which we may have today in our society, they didn't even have back then. Obviously, going to movies that are R-rated and watching things like that, they didn't have such thing. But well, they had their temple things going on, but and other questionable forms of entertainment or things like that. So be careful when you throw all of those into chapter 14. They may not apply, is what I'm saying. Okay. You know, there are Christians all over the world that consume alcohol of some kind. In some societies, in some countries, they do a lot more than we do here. My opinion might be that we do have some statements in the Bible about consuming alcohol you need to be careful about. But primarily, it is a testimony thing. And it is a statement to our society that alcohol has ruined so many people, so many families, that even if taking one social drink in my life would not hurt my body at all, I'm not going to do it for conscience sake, their conscience, and the testimony I have before them. How many? You know, I've often said, we discussed that when we made a constitution. Should we have that in our constitution, that we would like to be a group of people in a church that have agreed together we won't use alcoholic beverage? We talked about it, pro and con, and we decided let's leave that in because we would like to be in a church like that, who just practices that way. We're not condemning every Christian who does it a different way, but I think it's unwise, you know, that they do it that way. Okay, so they're those kind of things. How many times have I mentioned yoga and my problem with yoga? And there are lots of Christians who do exercising that way and the rest. I just think that that is something that is connected to a pagan belief, and that pagan belief is still practiced all over the world. And so I think we should not, there's so many ways to do exercise, why do it by tipping our hat to Hinduism as we do it? When people all over the world say, yes, that's my God. Praise the Lord, praise my God, you're doing it the way my God does it. You know, kind of like the man there in Romans or 1 Corinthians, you know. During that meat was offered to my God yesterday. I listened to Albert Mohler. He was talking about on one of his programs, he does these daily programs, how much Buddhism is growing in America right now. It's amazing the inroads that Buddhism has, from meditation to spiritual things to thinking. And Buddhism doesn't even have a God. To them, everything is God. God is a spirit that's in everything. But see, isn't it interesting? Once you throw out Christianity that has moral parameters, after that you have no moral parameters. Nothing matters. Truth or error doesn't matter to you. It's growing crazily in our society. Okay. All right. Questionable practices. And then notice the next one. But just as in Romans 14, some things that were forbidden under the law were permitted under grace, like food choices and holy days. We might have find similar things today. I tried to think of some. You can think of others. Clothing choices that mix type of materials. Remember, they could not mix different types of cloth in the same garment. We do that all the time, right? Look at your shoes. How many types of materialism, you know, does it take to make up a shoe, you know, these days and everything else? Working or playing on Sunday, obviously. Eating foods, I'm thinking there's a lot of people who won't eat certain additives in food if it's in there. Nothing wrong with that. Don't eat it if you don't want. Ann did daycare for a doctor's, she was a doctor, for their little boy. And she was very picky about things like that. And her rule was when you look at a label on something you're about to eat or drink, if you can't pronounce it, don't eat it. Which, to me, makes about half the things I eat go away, you know, because who can pronounce all of those? But that was what she said. If you can't pronounce it, don't eat it, because it's probably not good. And she never did, I suppose. And germ phobia, you know, Mitt Romney's birthday was this. Did you see that on the news? Mitt Romney had a birthday, and they had a cake with candles on it. Quite a few candles. Huh? Or a Twinkie cake. Okay, yeah. And rather than blowing the candles out, he picked every candle up one at a time, blew it out, put it over here, picked it. And you know why? Because a germ phobia person will not blow on a cake and then eat it, or won't eat a cake that someone else blew on. You may have seen this at a certain time, you know, and somebody blows the candles out in the cake, and then there's somebody who says, no thanks, I don't want any cake today, because they're just not going to eat it. Okay, I'm just saying, you know, to me, if a person want, you know, go for it. Try to eliminate all the germs you can. I don't know, you know. And another person says, that doesn't bother me at all. I ate dirt when I was a kid, and I'll eat dirt till I die. Okay. And neither one are right and wrong. You're right. But you have the freedom to do either. But also, why should you criticize each other for whichever way you do it? You have another example? Well, you know, I just think some things are beyond audiophora. I think they're really bad. Okra is English for the Greek oh crud. And shouldn't eat it. Okay. I've known people who will never use cash or coins, always use a credit card, because who knows where these coins have been and whose hands they've been in and so forth, you know. In your mouth, it could have been, you know. Who knows? Probably a good idea, you know, these days. Or eating at a buffet, you know. And they make you take another plate back, right? And things like that. Okay, you get the idea. All right. And we're getting beyond germs to just manners, right? I mean, you know, okay. Okay, last point. So Romans 14, 10 through 12 reminds us that the Bema seat will reveal how each individual Christian walked before God in his or her own conscience, in his or her own Christian growth. Because in these indifferent things, it doesn't matter one way or another unless you are hurting somebody with it or wounding your conscience that you need to keep. And not, you know, okay, well, I can do that, then I can do all those other things too. And you got to be careful with that, especially with new Christians. All of a sudden, you just open the door up to all kinds of things. Oh, I didn't know I could do all those, and then they're gone. Okay? One individual may have good reasons for not doing what another individual gladly does. We should not judge or condemn one another in these situations. The Lord alone knows our heart and will hold us accountable before Him. My pastor friend, who never played cards all of his life, I did find out it was because one time he was playing cards and he offended somebody and didn't know it. And because he offended that, which would have been a weaker brother or sister, whoever it was, he decided, I will never do this again. What did Paul say we did? We didn't read it in 1 Corinthians 10, but we could have. If I find that my eating meat causes my brother to offend, I'll not eat meat again as long as the world stands. So I have to give my friend credit for saying, then I just won't do it because I never know. And he was an older man. Maybe he knew his generation and so forth. I'll not take that chance again. So you know, I'm just saying, you never know why a person or how a person is doing that. Okay? All right. Good thoughts. I think, you know, again, these two verses, because they say at the end, every person will be judged by God for themselves. I even made the statement in here, I think I passed it by real quick, that back up in under 1 Corinthians 4, 5, the last point, you know, you, as parents, you can't be held responsible for everything your children do when they're out of your house and out of your care. But you will be accountable for what you did in your own home, right? As a pastor, I find out, you know, that in 1 Corinthians or in Hebrews chapter 13, that I I will have to give an account for ministry, but I have to give an account for how I've preached and what I've done, not whether or not you did it or not. That is your responsibility before God. I'm not going to be held accountable for that, but I will be held accountable for how I led. And the same with a parent. So you can't kill yourself over whether or not your kids or grandkids follow in your footsteps all the way, and that they'll stand before the Lord for themselves if you did the right thing. Okay. All right. Any other thoughts or comments about okra or anything?
I can testify that people are not eating.